The theme for President's Weekend, which is an event that has been going on for years, we used to participate in that and be a part of it when we were back there, and for the last 2 years now, since we drove last year to do our family vacation, we did that again, and each year there's a theme that's chosen, similar to what Winter Family Weekend. There's a theme, and we have themes for our summer camps. The theme for this President's Weekend in Branson was Be Strong and of Good Courage, and so there were 8 seminars, a Bible study, and, of course, the message on the Sabbath, and an additional presentation by Joel Meeker talking about the work and what's going on in Africa, and he tied that in with this theme as well, Be Strong and of Good Courage. Something that was exciting, something that we were able to all focus on, and you think, well, 8 to 10 messages all focused on Be Strong and of Good Courage, but of course, you can't hear all of them. I think you were able to get 4 out of the 8 seminars, and then the Bible study and the sermon, and then the extra presentation. But all of them focusing on different aspects of being strong and of good courage. The children of Israel were given a command, be strong and of good courage. Now, this is something that was passed on to Joshua, but it is something that was given to the children of Israel as well. That admonition was in the face of the physical challenges that they were going to have as they entered into the promised land. They were told, this is what you're going to inherit. This is where you're going. This is what you're going to achieve. But there's going to be obstacles along the way. And they were given this encouragement, be strong and of good courage. That message of strength and courage is something that was also given to the New Testament church. As the New Testament church began, as it began to grow, it also began to have problems. And strength and courage is a message that is also given to the New Testament church. And I think from that we can even take this and say, okay, we are to learn from the examples of what happened. There is strength and courage, and it is needed for us as well. They needed it, and so do we. I want to look at the definition, or several definitions, but the definitions of these two words, courage and strength. The Google Dictionary definition of courage is the ability to do something that frightens one. That's what courage is, the ability to do something that frightens one. Now, some people are afraid of spiders, that's arachnophobia. Others are afraid of the dark, others are afraid of confined spaces. But when they force themselves to get over that, some people are able to overcome that phobia or that fear because they were able to do something that frightened them. But that's what courage is, the ability to do something that frightens one. Strength in the face of pain or grief. Having pain or grief, but having strength to be able to work through it. Now, I don't think I could guarantee any of you, you're never going to have pain or grief. I could probably almost guarantee all of you will have pain or grief at some point. And there's different ways of facing that. This is facing it with strength. And again, that's what courage is, to face pain and grief, but to do it with strength. Now, you can face it and be hopeless. You can face it and feel overwhelmed, or you can face pain and grief with strength. And there is a huge difference. Synonyms for courage are bravery, braveness, courageousness, valor, fearlessness, intrepidity, intrepidness, nerve, daring, or boldness. Now, we're told that we can boldly come before God's throne. Many fear being in the presence of God. They fear God as being a harsh God or a God that is unapproachable. But God says when you have His Spirit, you have the ability to approach His throne boldly or with courage, to go before Him and to not be afraid. But these other words, again, also describe what courage is. Bravery, courageousness, valor. Now, the word strength, there are several different definitions. I want to focus on one in particular. A definition of strength is the degree of intensity of a feeling or belief. The degree of intensity of a feeling or belief. So you've got a belief, but you have a belief that has intensity. You have something behind it, something that gives it power. Synonyms for strength are intensity, vehemence, Now, we see in God's Word when He says, when you come to a true understanding of sorrow, a godly sorrow, He says what vehement it creates in you, a degree of intensity. Another synonym is force, forcefulness, depth, ardor, fervor, and an antonym for this word, something that is opposite of strength, is half-heartedness. What a good description. If the word strength means intensity and vehemence, you think of power, you think of having the ability to do something, the opposite is doing things half-hearted. So what does it mean to have strength? And as we sit here today and as we look at the encouragement of be strong and of good courage, what does it mean to us? Are we doing things half-hearted, or are we doing things with strength, with a vehement desire? Do you have a depth and an intensity in your Christian life? Depth and intensity. Now, only you know that. Others can say, well, I can tell by their fruits that they're half-hearted. Only you know whether you are vehement, whether you have an intensity, or whether you're doing something half-hearted. What is it that we face today that we need strength and good courage for? There's things that lie ahead for you and I before the return of Jesus Christ, and I can almost guarantee you will need strength and good courage. We have to be strong. Let's go back to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 31. Deuteronomy chapter 31 and verse 6. Deuteronomy 31 and verse 6. He says, "Be strong and of good courage. Do not fear, nor be afraid of them. For the Lord your God, He is the one who goes with you, and He will not leave you or forsake you." This is one of the places that this phrase is mentioned, of being strong and of good courage. He says, "Be strong and of a good courage. Do not fear or be afraid of them." Verses 3 through 5 describe who them are. If He's saying, "Be strong and of good courage and don't be afraid of them," who are them? We see these, you know, the commercials sometimes for, I think it's Sonic that does, well, who are them? You know, or they say, well, who are they? He says, don't be afraid of them. Deuteronomy 31 and verse 3 says, "The Lord your God crosses over before you. He will destroy these nations from before you." Giving us the context of who He's speaking of. "And you shall dispossess them. Joshua himself crossed over before you, just as the Lord had said. The Lord will do to them as He did to Sihon and Og and the king of the Amorites and their land, and He, or when He destroyed them. The Lord will give them over to you, and that you may do to them according to every commandment which I have commanded you." He's talking about all the nations, the things that they were going to have to face as individuals and as a nation. He says, don't fear them. They may look powerful, and of course they came back with reports in various times where these are giants in the land, we're like grasshoppers in their sight. We can't go against these individuals. They're big. Well, God says, don't fear them. Be strong and of courage, and do not fear or be afraid of them. It wasn't just a suggestion. He was saying, you don't have to fear them. And He explained to us in verse 6 why. He said, "For the Lord your God, He is the one that goes with you." If God is with you, who can be against you? There's nothing to fear. So He says, be strong and of good courage. What do these two words, strong and courage, mean here? And what are the implications for us? How can we benefit from these two words, strength and courage? And how can you and I benefit from this admonition that is given to the Old Testament, and as we'll see, is also given to the New Testament? We'll dig a little bit deeper into these two words. Two simple words, but hold a lot of meaning, and that's why so many messages could be given on the same topic. It's just going in different directions, and there's several verses that it is mentioned in, and each one has a unique addition to it or explanation to it. Strong's Exhaustive Concordance says the Hebrew word for fear is Y-A-R-E, pronounced Yare. And it means to fear, to frighten, or to put in fear. You know, when somebody puts you in fear, or you put someone else in fear, that's what this word fear means. Now the words be afraid, he says, do not be afraid. That is the word A-R-A-T-S. And it's pronounced all rats. Now, somebody puts you in fear and you say all rats. It's an easy way to remember it. To be put in fear, to be afraid of something, all rats. What was it that they feared? Well, this root word of be afraid means to dread, to be frightened, to be terrified, or to shake terribly. It's not just a fear of something, but it is to be totally frightened. He said, don't shake and tremble before these individuals, or to be terrified by them. So what was it that they feared, and why did they fear that? Well, Israel did not have a solid trust in God. They didn't have a relationship with God as they should. And they feared other people. They feared what would be done to them. Now, they had been in captivity, and we understand that they were slaves. And so maybe they were thinking, I don't want to go back into slavery. I don't want to put myself in a position where that might be jeopardized. I'm out of being a slave right now. I'm out of Egypt. But they feared other people. It's one of the main reasons that people live in fear today, that they don't have a deep relationship with God, and they don't understand that when God says, I will be with you, I will walk with you, you don't have to be afraid of certain things. There's a comfort that comes from that. So he says not to fear. They feared the unknown. They didn't know what was ahead for them. They didn't know what is going to be coming upon Israel. We know what we had. In fact, we know they looked at it that way because they looked back and they said, we want to go back to where we had leeks and onions. We want to go back to where it was so nice and we had all these wonderful things. No, that's what they looked at. That's what they knew. But now they're looking at the kingdom, at the physical kingdom that they were to inherit, the promised land. And they didn't know what it was. So they had a fear of the unknown. Today, people fear the unknown. That is a common and typical fear for many people, fearing the unknown. I remember going from grade school into junior high. I had some anxiety. I didn't know what junior high was like, and especially going into high school. And then you go to college, and there's a little bit of fear of the unknown. And you get there, and you realize, oh, that wasn't as bad as what I thought it would be. You work your way in through things. You face the fear. But the fear of the unknown, and people have that fear today, don't they? The fear of the unknown. Well, I don't know what's going to happen in this situation. And so instead of asking God for strength and courage, instead of focusing on God being with you, they focus on, I don't know, so now I have to fear the unknown. Fear what's ahead. The fear of the unknown is called xenophobia. X-E-N-O-P-H-O-B-I-A. Xenophobia. It's fearing what can't be seen or known. It is fearing what is beyond our comfort zone. You have a comfort zone. Okay, I know what things are. I know what things are like. I can see things. I know what I have around me. But anything beyond that, I don't know. So there's a fear of what is beyond our comfort zone. Fearing what can't be seen or known, which is what faith is. When faith is not the fear, but faith is you have that fear of what's unknown, but God says this is what's going to happen, and there's a confidence in knowing that there's something that is given to you, and it is going beyond that fear to realize I can see what's ahead of me, even though you know you're seeing what is not seen, you're knowing what is not known by many people. It's overcoming that fear of the unknown. Seeing what can't be seen and knowing what can't be known. Just as a note, this phrase, do not fear, is used 51 times in the New King James Version. 51 times, do not fear. Now, when God tells that directly to us, and usually with, as we read in verse 6, usually with, I am with you, or don't fear because I'm going to be taking care of you. I will be your rear guard. I will be before you. I will go before you. What do people fear today? And what is it that people are afraid of? Now, I don't mean in the world, because people have all kinds of fears in the world, and some are justified fears. Some people have a fear of heights. Some people have a fear of other things. But I mean in the church, what do people fear today? As the people of God, what is there that people are afraid of? Because some do continue to have fear. When God was speaking to Israel, he wasn't talking about, well, everybody out in the world shouldn't fear. He said, Israel, you shouldn't fear. You shouldn't be afraid because I am with you. In the church, some fear death. Not just the death when we age and reach the age, our allotted time for man, and we go beyond that. But they fear sudden death or unexpected death. John chapter 16, verse 1 says, these things I have spoken to you that you should not be made to stumble. They will put you out of the synagogue. Yes, the time is coming that whoever kills you will think that he does God a service. And so people fear. They go, wow, that could happen to us. Someday I have to be killed. Now, I've heard people say, every living human being at the end time is going to be killed. Every person in the church. And I said, that's not what Scripture says. Well, he says, they're going to take you up and kill you, and they're going to do that to everyone. I said, no. God also talks about people being protected in a place of safety. He also says, you know, there are various things that happen to the people of God. And some over the years, as we have seen in the decades, have lived out their life and have died, and they will be among the first who are resurrected. But people fear, well, if they're going to come against you and think they're doing God a service and they're going to kill you. And so people look at that and they go, it's not bad now, but it's going to get bad. And I fear having to face that. Fear having to face death. I don't know how many times you have heard a statement, I don't want to die in the Great Tribulation. People who come into the church, and some because of fear, they fear the Great Tribulation. They fear what's to take place. They've read about it. They study it and they go, I believe that. And they believe what's going to happen, and they take the fear instead of believing that God also says, if you're doing your part, and I will be with you, and even if you do have to go through some of those things, that he will continue to be with us. Now, you look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and I've brought them up several times recently, but there's several lessons from that. And they said, our God is able to deliver us, but if he doesn't, be it known, we're still not going to bow down and worship. Because they knew that God would be with them in the physical life or in their spiritual life, but he would be with them. And again, there's a comfort that comes through that. So individuals fear death. They fear going through the Great Tribulation. Others fear persecution. Now, persecution can come from many different directions. It can come in school. It can come from work. It can come from neighbors. But individuals fear persecution. And again, persecution comes by other people. They fear what people can do. Just as the nation of Israel, they feared them. They feared the nations that they were going to have to dispossess. Individuals fear persecution. John 15, verse 20 says, remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they have kept my word, they will keep yours also. But all these things will they do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know him who had sent me. So he said, if they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you. Now, individuals, when they come to the knowledge of the truth, they're excited about all the promises and what they're learning. But when they get to some of these things, people fear persecution. If they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you. And so people fear the unknown. When is persecution going to come? When am I going to be persecuted? Hopefully we don't have that frame of mind. But that is a fear. And it is a fear of some, even within the church. Some fear tribulation. I mentioned the Great Tribulation, but some just fear tribulation altogether. Let's go to John chapter 16, verse 33. John chapter 16. And in verse 33, "These things have I spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation." That's one of those guarantees. He says, in the world you're going to have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I've overcome the world. So he says, if you're going to be a Christian, it's almost guaranteed you're going to have some type of tribulation. If you work for an employee who's not in the church, tribulation is probably going to come your direction at some point. Even if it's smooth now, even if things are going well, at some point you will probably have tribulation. Or, oh, well, my teacher has no problem with the holy days. My teacher lets me off. And the next year you get a new teacher and the teacher says, you can't do this. You are not going to go away for a week. You're not going to get off for holy days. And you got to face the tribulation. Personal tribulation. Just because we are a Christian and we are God's people, as he says, you belong to me, it doesn't mean we're not going to have trials. Some have told me in the church, if we're Christian, if we're doing what's right, we will not have trials and tribulation. That's not what God says. He says, in this world, you are going to have tribulation. He says, we will. Acts 7, verse 52 says, which of the prophets have not your fathers persecuted? And they have slain them, which showed before of the coming of the just one, and before, and you have been now the betrayers and murderers. So what does it mean by persecution? He says, if we're going to have persecution, we're going to have tribulation. He says here, the prophets, which of the prophets have your fathers not persecuted? What does it mean by persecution? Persecution means to chase, to pursue, to harass, to intimidate, to punish, or to kill. Now, many individuals I know here have been harassed by individuals. Sometimes you're harassed by family, intimidated, or punished. And you think, well, I'm doing what's right and I'm punished. Well, God says if you're doing what's right and you're punished, then it's something that is good, something you can stand for. But what does it mean by persecution here? John chapter 15, verse 20 says, remember the word that I said to you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they persecuted me, as we read, they will persecute you. If they've kept my saying, they're going to keep yours also. So would God allow the church to be persecuted? Some say, well, persecution will never come upon the church because the church is, that's God's, and God will not allow persecution to come upon it. Let's go to Acts chapter 1, or Acts chapter 8, rather, verse 1. Acts 8 and verse 1. It says, and Saul was consenting unto his death, and at that time there was great persecution against the church. Persecution against the church. Now, this is when the church has begun. Acts gives us a description of the Acts of the Apostles, the Acts of the New Testament church. And he says that the time, at that time there was great persecution against the church, which was at Jerusalem, and they were scattered abroad throughout the regions of Judea, Samaria, except the apostles. It has happened before. There has been persecution against the church. If you've been in the church for decades, you realize there's been a lot of persecution against the church in various ways. Persecution against the church. We live in a time right now that has been relatively peaceful. For multiple years, we have lived in peace. But it may not always be that way. There's always the possibility of persecution against the church. It's something that we realize, it's something that we face. The society that we live in, as laws are passed, as the world begins to change values, we see many things changing around us, and those who stand up and say, "This God says you cannot do that," well, don't bring God into the picture. Don't bring God's word into the picture of the Bible. We are going to change what we're going to change, and the world begins to go astray. But if you stand up for truth, if you stand up for what is right, you will be persecuted. Now, persecution that direction, you don't see the court saying, "Oh, you shouldn't persecute a Christian for their beliefs." You say, "No, don't persecute the person who comes up with this new belief or this new understanding." Matthew chapter 5 and verse 10. Matthew 5 and beginning in verse 10. He says, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake." Again, if you're doing what's right, you're living up to the standard, and you get persecuted for it, you say, "Well, this isn't right." No, it's not right. But God says, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and they persecute you, and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my name." I don't know about you, but I've had people say false things against me. I've had them revile me. I've had them persecute me. Still here today. And over time, you begin to develop a strength where you realize, it doesn't matter what they say. It doesn't matter the persecution that they bring. It hurts at the time, but in the long run, you go, "God says he's with me. I know if I'm doing what is right, whether I'm persecuted now, doesn't matter because there's something ahead." And we'll see that. We'll look at the life of an individual. Well, let me go ahead and read verse 11 and 12, and then we'll move into that. It says, "Blessed are you when you revile, and when they revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil things against you. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So they were persecuted too. But he said, you've got a great reward ahead. Something to look forward to. I want to look at one individual in the life of one individual in particular. An individual who was used by God. An individual who was trained and was one of the apostles of Jesus Christ. He suffered trials, tribulations, difficulties, all of those things that individuals fear. I fear persecution. I fear death. I fear being tormented. I fear going through tribulations and trials. This individual went through those things. And again, when we look at the example of what he experienced, what he had to go through, and what his mindset was as he was going through these things, but also at the end. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 20. 2 Corinthians 11 verse 20. He says, "For you put up with it if one brings you into bondage, if one devours you, if one takes from you, if one exalts himself, or if one strikes you on the face. To our shame, I say that we were too weak for that. But in whatever anyone is bold, I speak foolishly, I am bold also. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I." Talking about the Apostle Paul. And verse 23, he says, "Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. In labors more abundant. In stripes above measure. In prison more frequently. And in deaths often. From the Jews I received 40 stripes minus one." Or five times I received 40 stripes minus one. Think about that for a moment. Do our persecutions and trials even compare to that one particular suffering that the Apostle Paul had to go through? Five times I received 40 stripes minus one. Now we get persecuted today, or your boss says, if you don't do this, you're going to lose your job. That's a little bit more mild than 40 stripes minus one. And of course, many times if you stand up for that, eventually God provides you with something better. It was a command in Deuteronomy 25 and verse 3 that says, do not beat someone over 40 times. And so they stopped at 39. They wanted to always make sure that they went one short of 40 stripes. So they made sure to stop short. In fact, they developed a method. Barnes' note says that they usually made use of a scourge that had three thongs on it. and it was struck against an individual 13 times. Now, if you're whipping with one and you're counting, you could get close to I miscounted. Now I gave him more than 40. Now I'm in jeopardy of breaking this particular law. So they made a scourge that had three thongs on it. So each time it was hit, that's three stripes. And so they would do that 13 times against an individual. So the Apostle Paul here says five times he was beaten that way. Five times he received stripes, 40 stripes minus one. Verse 25, he says, three times I was beaten with rods, or beaten with a stick. Don't think it was just a little tiny stick. I mentioned when I was in Missouri growing up, and some of you may have had experienced the same thing when you had a switch taken to you. And your parents or your grandparents said, you go out and get a switch. You don't come back with a little flimsy or breakable one because they say, that's not going to work. Go back and get a real one. You know it's going to hurt. But here, he said, I was beaten with rods or sticks. Once I was stoned. I don't think any of us could ever claim, well, we've been persecuted so badly, I was stoned one time. I had people throwing rocks at me and being stoned. Yet the Apostle Paul faced that. Three times I was shipwrecked. These things almost seem like, how could all of this happen to one person? Three times I was shipwrecked, and night and day I have been in the deep. Now, bad luck happens to people, but to have all of these things, and Paul, the Apostle Paul was going through and explaining, all of these things have happened to me. We go through wilderness first aid training every couple of years. Mr. John Pinelli and myself have been going the last every other year for the last few years. And in our last class, we were covering snake bites. And they said, how many of you have ever been bitten by a rattlesnake? No hands went up. That's a rare thing. They're saying it happens more and more. And it's interesting that most of the snake bites now are young men, just in their late teens or early 20s. And it used to be snake bite on the hand because they were seeing who could grab it. And it would bite them. Now, more common is the same age group, men, late teens, early 20s, snake bite, but it's on the face because they're trying to get a selfie with a snake and the snake bites them. Those things that you learn when you go through wilderness first aid. But so nobody had been bitten by a snake in our class. And the instructor brought up, he said, we had one individual who said, yes, he'd been bitten by a rattlesnake, which was uncommon. He said, it's very rare that we have somebody in the class who had. The individual had been bitten by a rattlesnake, he had been attacked by a bear, and he'd also been bitten by a shark. And I thought, those three things are very rare of any individual, let alone one individual having it all together. But it sounds like what the Apostle Paul was talking about here. He's been beaten with five times, 40 stripes minus one. He had been imprisoned, he had been stoned, he had been beaten with rods, and he had been shipwrecked. And it says, a day and night I have been in the deep. Apparently, floating 24 hours, either hanging on to a plank or in a small craft, if they was able to get into a craft, but being out at sea for 24 hours without help. Verse 26, he says, in journeys often, in perils of water, perils of robbers. Okay, so he had been robbed. Perils of my own countrymen, perils of Gentiles, and perils of the city, perils in the wilderness, perils at sea, and perils among false brethren. It's interesting he throws that in, that now he received perils among false brethren. He had to deal with false brethren, individuals who claimed to be members of the church but were not, individuals that came against him. He said in verse 27, in weariness and in toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and in thirst, in fastings often, in the cold and nakedness. Besides the other things, what comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the church, for all the churches. I don't think any of us can even compare to what the Apostle Paul describes here in the tribulations and the persecutions which he went against. those things that were brought against him. But I think that's why the Apostle Paul can say with authority when he makes the statement, "For I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us." He says there's something ahead that the sufferings of this time, whether it be shipwrecks and beatings and scourgings, he can look back and go, yeah, those were terrible things, but it can't even compare to what's ahead. He had that mindset. He didn't fear. He was strong and of good courage. He continued to move forward and even says, "I don't look back. I'm looking forward to what is ahead." We can't let tribulation make us fearful. We can't let persecution be something that makes us fearful. Be strong and of good courage. So he says, be of good cheer. Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 8. Revelation 2 and verse 8. This is a message to the churches. And he says in verse 8, "To the angel of the church of Smyrna write, these things says the first and the last who is dead and came to life. I know your works, your tribulation, your poverty." He said, you've had to suffer tribulation. Now, this is talking to the church of Smyrna, but we understand that the message itself is given to all of the church. He said, "I know your works, your tribulation, your poverty. I know the blasphemy against those who say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. Do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer." Now, looking forward for us, we know that the scenes are changing. The world is changing. And what is ahead for mankind, you can either be fearful of it and go, oh, it's getting bad and it's going to get worse and worse, and have a fear of the future or a fear of the unknown. Or you can take the message here in verse 10, "Do not fear those things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you in prison, and you may be tested, and you will have tribulation for 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life." He said, even if you have to physically be killed, be faithful unto death, I'm going to give you a crown of life. This is what Paul was saying, that there's something ahead, that the tribulations, the trials, the difficulties are not even worthy to be compared to what God says, I have ahead for you. Message was not just to Smyrna. When we look at verse 11, "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death." To him who overcomes, to him who faces the fears, faces the challenges, faces the tribulations, and those who do it with strength and courage. Today, people fear very similar things as the Israelites did. We look at it in a little different light. We don't look at it as, well, we're overcoming and taking over a land, taking over an area, and there's giants in the land. But we look at it in a different way, that there's a lot of different challenges in the modern age that we live in. But there's not a reason to live in fear. God tells us we don't have to be fearful, and we can look at things differently. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 17. 2 Corinthians 4:17. He says, "For our light affliction..." Now, light affliction, you may say, well, no, my affliction is more than light. "For our light affliction, which is for but a moment, is working for us far more exceedingly an eternal weight of glory." He said, whatever trial you're going through, whatever it is that you feel is burdening you down, he calls it a light affliction. It's for a moment. This life and the physical life we are in is temporary. And he said, those things pass. I've been through severe trials. Many of you have been through severe trials. Some of you through health trials or health difficulties, or have had things happen in your life where, wow, this is, I've never had to experience this before. But it says, which is for but a moment. It's not lasting. It's not something that is going to continue for eternity. It is for a moment. But there's something we're working towards that is greater, an eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but we look at those things that are not seen. We don't have a fear of the unknown. We don't have a fear of, well, I don't know what's ahead for the future. The world does. And that's why many of them do fear, because they don't have a hope. They don't have understanding of the future. But he says, we look at the things that are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary. The things that we experience today, the things that we have knowledge of, he says, those are temporary. But the things which are not seen are eternal. The things that are not seen, the unknown, the things that God is preparing for us, the things that he's revealing to us, they are eternal. Barnes' note states, the things which are seen are temporal. It refers to particular things which they suffered. But it is also true for all the things below, wealth, pleasure, fame, the three idols to which people of this world adore. Wealth, pleasure, and fame are temporary. They're not lasting. It's not something that an individual is going to continue to have. It's not something that they will have for eternity. And it says, all endure for only a little time, but soon they will vanish. So is it with pain, sorrow, and tears. Now that gets a little bit more personal. Pain, sorrow, and tears, they're also temporary, because there's a time that God says they will not be. All that we enjoy and all that we suffer here are soon to vanish and disappear. What we are experiencing physically and what we go through in this physical life is temporary. And we realize that can't be the focus, avoiding temporary pain, avoiding temporary tribulation or trial. It's the future. And we focus on those things that are not seen. So in referencing being strong and of good courage, we're looking at these two particular phrases of strength and courage, and they work together, but there's deep meaning and understanding of what it provides for us as we use those. Do we know where strength comes from? Is it something that we are able to build up in ourselves? If it's something where we say, well, I'm going to dedicate myself and I'm going to build that strength. The Psalms are full of David's life, and David knew and understood where his strength came from. I'm not going to turn to these, but I'm going to read through some of the Psalms as David expresses strength and where his strength was. Psalm 18, verse 2. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God and my strength, in whom I will trust. He said, God is my strength, and I'm going to trust in him. He's my shield and my horn of salvation and my stronghold. Psalm 18, verse 32, it is God who arms me with strength. David didn't say, because of all my military knowledge and because of my great experience as a leader, this is where my strength comes from. No, he says, it's God who arms me with strength, and he makes my way perfect. Psalm 18, 39, you have armed me with strength for the battle. You have subdued under me those who rose up against me. He said he's giving God the credit for what he was achieving and what God expected from him. Psalm 19, verse 14. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Psalm 20, verse 6. Now I know that the Lord saves his anointed. He will answer him from the heaven, from his holy heaven with the saving strength of his right hand. Again, recognizing where that strength comes from. The Psalms go on and on. In Deuteronomy, God says, for the Lord your God, when he said, be strong and of good courage, the Lord your God, he is the one who goes with you and he will not leave you or forsake you. We have to believe that. We have to understand that. And with that comes a comfort and strength. Let's go back to Joshua. We'll look at another one of these 51 places where it tells us not to be fearful. But in Joshua, this command of being strong and of good courage is given as well. Joshua chapter 1 and verse 6. Joshua 1 and verse 6. Be strong and of good courage. For to this people you should divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. He said, be strong and of good courage, because I'm going to give you what I've told you I had promised you. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. So he says, be strong and courageous because I'm going to give you this. But he didn't say, you don't have to do anything. You just wait for it. No, he said, be strong and courageous, but only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to the law. That you may observe is a phrase that means to guard or protect. That phrase, that you may observe, in the original means guard or protect. Guard and protect according to all the law that was given to you. Protect what I have given you. Guard over it. There's a duty given to us. And in that, he says, be strong and courageous because you have a duty to protect and to guard these things. Protect all that God has given to us. It's actively fighting and protecting his way of life. That comes with an attitude. And again, when we looked at the definitions of these two words of strength and courage, a lot of it has to do with attitude. The vehement desire, the understanding to be bold because of what God promises to give us and promises to be there. But he doesn't just say be strong and courageous and sit back and watch. He said be strong and courageous and be very courageous. Guard my law. Protect it. Do not turn from the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. Verse 8, the book of this law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night. He said, yeah, be strong and courageous, but here's some things for you to do, and here's some things that are going to strengthen you. He says, meditate on it day and night, that you may observe to do all that is written, according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you, be strong and of good courage? Now, repetition is used as a reinforcement. When God is trying to emphasize something, especially in Scripture, when it's repeated multiple times and sometimes like this in just a few verses, it tells us to be strong and of good courage, be very strong and very courageous. And then he says here that we have to observe things, but be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid nor dismayed. For, and the word literally means because. When it says, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go, it's because the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. This word for is literally because. He says, be strong and of good courage, don't be afraid or dismayed, because I am with you wherever you go. You don't have a need to be fearful. Don't be afraid because God is there. Now, having an understanding of God being there is much different than just saying, I believe that God exists. Now, people come to the doors and they knock and they say, do you believe in God? Or do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Savior? But they're just asking a simple yes or no question, and they say, oh, good, you're saved, or you're a believer. What does it mean that God is there? Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 6 says, without faith, it's impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. He said, to have faith, he who comes to God must believe that he is. Now, it doesn't just mean, oh, I believe that God created the heavens and the earth. I believe that God is the one who inspired the Bible. Sometimes people look at God being, or knowing that God exists, as past tense. Yes, he created. Yes, he inspired. Not, yes, he is. And here it says, he that comes to God must believe that he is. Not just that he was, not just that he was the God who inspired the Bible, but that he is. The word here means he exists. He's present. Not just he existed in the past, but he's here. And he said, when he says, I will be with you, he doesn't just mean the children of Israel. He tells us, I will be with you. It means he exists. He remains. He is present. So we understand that God is present progressive. He's here. He's been in the past, and he will be in the future. He will always be there. And by this context, he's stating that he will always be there for you. That when he says, I'm not going to leave you, that I will be there for you, don't be afraid, this is what he's telling us. If we don't know that, then it's something we have to work on. And now is the time to begin to develop that type of relationship where you know that God exists, that God is there, and that God is actively working with you, that God is actively going to be present with you when you make those steps toward him. And that's why he says he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him, those who seek to have a relationship with him. And as you seek to have that relationship, he says, I'm going to reward you for it, but you're also going to understand that God is, that he's there, and that he will always be that he will always be there. He goes on to say that he's a rewarder. According to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the phrase, and that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him, diligently seek him, and that he is a word that means he proves to be, or he becomes. He proves to be a rewarder of those who seek him. Just like he says, test me and try me with tithing, and I'll see if I'll not open up and pour out a blessing upon you and open the windows of heaven. He says, I will do something. He becomes the rewarder if we do what he says. So it means to prove or to become. He proves to be a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. It's that kind of relationship that we need to develop. It's a faith that involves and requires a relationship with God. To understand that God will never leave us. Do we fear that he will leave us on our own? That's another fear that people have had within the church. Been called to the truth, I understand it. But individuals sometimes have a fear that, well, because I'm struggling, because I've committed sin, I'm afraid that God has just left me. Or people who struggle and they can't seem to get their prayer life together. And I don't have a relationship with God. I fear like I've lost my relationship with God. Do we fear that he will leave us on our own? Fear of being alone is another common fear that people have. Fear of being abandoned. Fear of being alone. Fear of doing things by ourselves. There's a fear of being separated from God, even within the church. And individuals have gotten to that point. But some have fear, well, I've gone too far. I don't know if I can ever get back to that relationship with God. God says, I will never leave you or forsake you. I will be there. It's a matter of putting forth the effort and having the strength and courage to go back to God. Are there promises from God that he will always be there if we do our part? Let's go to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. And in verse 31. Romans chapter 8 and verse 31. What shall we say then to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Who can come against you if God is on your side? It's like, you know, when you're a child, and I remember maybe it wasn't like this for others, but when I was in grade school, they always had the bullies in the park, and I've had bullies threaten me after school, I'm going to beat you up. And I remember one time walking across the field, across the playground, and I saw the guy who told me he was going to beat me up, and he was a couple grades past me, a bigger guy, and he had his four friends, and they're all sitting there pounding their fist. And I started finding as many friends as I could very quickly. These guys are going to beat me up. And so by the time I got over there, I think I had like six or eight guys with me, and they just let us pass. They didn't do anything because I had people with me. Having God on your side, what a difference. He says, who can say to these things, if God is for us, who can be against us? Who can come against God the Creator? He who did not spare his own Son, but delivered him up for us, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It's God that justifies. Now, I've had somebody come to me after reading this passage one time, and they go, yes, but people do bring charges against you. And they will. as we read earlier, people are going to bring false charges against you, or they're going to say, he may be baptized, but I, especially when I go back to where I was 40 years ago, I knew him as a teenager, as a little boy. I know he was ornery. I know what he did. Who can bring a charge against you if God has justified you? If God says, I've forgiven you, your slate is clean, you have been cleansed by the blood of Jesus Christ, who's going to bring a charge against you? They can't do it with a true justification. Who is he who condemns? It is Christ who died and furthermore is also risen, who is at the right hand of God and who also makes intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Now, as Paul went through Romans 6, 7, and 8, he's talking about the change, the conversion process, and now he's saying there's a promise given to us. Who is going to separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation? People fear tribulation. They fear things coming against them. Is that going to separate you from Christ's love? Distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, or sword. As it is written, for your sake we are killed all the day long, we are counted as sheep for the slaughter. You're going to run into these things. Yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am persuaded that neither life nor death nor angels or principalities or powers nor things present nor things to come, nor any height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Jesus Christ our Lord. He says nothing is going to separate his love for us. The bottom line, he is there. And when he is there, there is a strength and the courage that comes with it. The other side of the equation is you. He says, I will be there for you. Nothing will separate my love for you. The other side of the equation is, are you going to be committed and not allow your love for him or the love for his way of life or his law to be taken away or separated? We can go through life fearing what is going to happen to us. We can fear what others might say, what others might do. Some people have that type of fear. You may even have to experience that as a part of the church. And many of you will. The more committed you are, the more dedicated you are to values and truth and God's way of life, people are going to persecute you because that is uncommon in today's society. But we have to be strong and we have to show courage. Don't worry and don't fear about your physical life. Luke 17:32 says, remember Lot's wife, whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. Now, some have looked at that and they say, well, if you seek to save your life, you're going to lose it. Well, you know, everybody should seek to protect their own life. If fear for your life or fear of what's going to happen to you or fear what's going to come against you is your focus, he said, you're going to lose it. It's one of the things, he said, it's appointed unto men once to die. You're going to lose it. I knew an individual during the split, an individual who was pastoring a congregation, and during the time in 1995, he said, well, I don't believe the new teachings, but I can't go back to doing what I did before in my previous job. So I'm going to stay, and I'm going to teach it. He feared loss of job. Pretty shocking to us, something that we didn't expect, but he was trying to protect his life. Didn't prioritize things in the right way. Within a couple of years, he lost his job anyway. His job was lost. It wasn't a protected thing because he was seeking something physical. Shouldn't be the focus of life. If we seek to save our lives, if we seek to keep what we have, and that's why he says, remember Lot's wife. She looked back longingly for what she had in Sodom and Gomorrah. There are more important things than to seek to save our physical life, physical desires, physical wants, physical needs. All of those things are temporary. God says we have to be willing to give it all up and willing to sacrifice all those wants, needs, and desires to follow him. So how do we lose our lives? 1 Corinthians 6:20 says, we are bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. You are bought with a price. 1 Corinthians 7:23, do not be the servants of men. It's a great example of not fearing what men can do, not fearing them as was commanded to Israel. Don't fear what men can do. You are bought with a price. Don't be the servants of men. Don't get wrapped up in being caught up and doing and fearing what man is going to do and what he's going to bring against you. God says, you're bought with a price. You belong to me. And belonging to God and having God say, I will be with you. I am by your side. I will lead you. I will guide you. And I will always be with you. That's something that others cannot take away. I want to look at in the New Testament, a very similar phrase. 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 13. 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 13. He says, watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong. Let all that you do be done with love. This watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong, be courageous and have strength. The New Testament individuals, those who were coming to be a part of the church, were given this command to watch, stand fast in the faith, be strong and courageous, be brave and strong. Clark commentary says, be strong, put forth all the vigor and energy which God has given to you into maintaining and propagating the truth. And with your spiritual strength, you will increase by usage. Vigor and energy. When we go back to the original descriptions of what strength is, to be strong here is to have vigor and energy, to be vehement. He says here in Clark's commentary, the terms in this verse are military. Watch and watch you and be continually on your guard lest you be surprised by your enemies. Keep your scouts out and all your sentinels at their post lest the enemy steal a march upon you. See that the place that you are in is properly defended and that each are alert to perform their duty. So he says, what is being listed here is a military approach. Stand fast in the faith. This is actually meaning keep in your ranks. Do not be disorderly. Be determined to keep your ranks unbroken and keep close together. Stand fast in the faith. Now, most of the time when we look at that phrase, we're probably thinking, stand fast in the faith. That's my personal thing. I have to stand fast in the faith. And we do. But he says in this phrase, stand fast in the faith is to keep in your ranks, to keep with those who are standing fast, to keep your ranks unbroken, to keep close together. Henry commentary says, to watch, or that they should watch, is to be wakeful upon their guard. A Christian is always in danger. When you're a Christian, you realize that you're always in danger. You're in danger of somebody persecuting you. You're in danger of living God's way of life when the world is not around you. A Christian is always in danger, and therefore they should always be on the watch. And the danger is greater at some times than under other circumstances. Part of strength and courage is unity. When it says you keep in the ranks, stand fast in the faith, keep the ranks, keep together as a body and as a unit, there is strength and courage that come from unity. Keeping in the ranks. Remaining steadfast in the faith, steadfast in beliefs, steadfast in the church. Hebrews chapter 10. And verse 22. Let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope. He said, you hold on to that confession. You hold on to the hope. You hold on to what is not seen. Having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience. And again, holding fast to the profession of our hope. Without wavering, for he is faithful, he who has promised is faithful. And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. Let us consider one another. Consider one another in this phrase means watch and observe. Now we're told before, watch and keep your ranks. Here, consider one another means watch and observe. How do we do that if we're not together? If you're not a part of the body, and if you don't continually come back together as a part of the body, how do you watch and observe? Or how do you consider one another to stir up another to good works? How do we do that if we don't spend time with one another? Some today simply don't understand that. They don't see the need to hold the ranks. They don't see a need to keep the ranks unbroken. That, well, it doesn't really matter. This is a personal thing. I don't need to be a part of a group or a rank. Verse 25 says, not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together. He said this is exactly what he's saying. Don't forsake being together to encourage one another, to strengthen one another. As the manner of some is, but exhorting one another so much more as you see the day approaching. That phrase, so much more as you see the day approaching, as the months and the years go by, we see more and more that the day is approaching and that is coming. And there is a greater need for individuals to have strength and courage and to strengthen and encourage one another. So in Corinthians, we're told to stand fast in the faith, be together in our beliefs, encourage one another, be brave and be strong. After all that the Apostle Paul had gone through and after all that he had to endure, Paul remained strong and courageous. By definition, strength means a degree of intensity of belief. And I don't think after reading any of Paul's writings, you would disagree that Paul had an intensity of belief. Going before Agrippa, Agrippa said, you've almost convinced me to be a Christian. Paul was determined. He was enthusiastic. He had a vehement desire and he had a boldness. He had strength, a degree of intensity of belief. He also had courage, strength in the face of pain or grief. Strength in the face of pain or grief. In all the things he had to go through, all the things that he endured, which is far more than I've ever had to experience or anything probably all of us combined would have to experience. I don't think we can get several shipwrecks and beatings and scourging and stonings out of our entire congregation. Yet he had courage. He had strength in the face of pain and grief. He kept moving forward. He said, I look for what's ahead because what this life has is temporary. It cannot be compared to what God has laid out for us. Do we have strength and courage like Paul did, even after going through all that he had to endure? One last passage, 2 Timothy chapter 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7. In his admonition to Timothy, as he was training him and preparing him for the job that he had, he also discusses his own life. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7. He says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. And Paul understood he was coming to the end of his life. I fought the good fight. I finished the faith. I have kept the faith. He's preserved it. He fought for it. He stood up for it. And he said, finally, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day. He said, there is that crown laid up for me. He knows and knew what was ahead for him. But he says, and not to me only, but to all, but also to all who have loved his appearing. He said, it's available to you and I, and to everyone who that it has been given to, and they hold on to it, and they establish what he did through his trials and difficulties, through the lessons he learned in being strong and of good courage.